Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KCI FM in Irvine.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Hi, I'm Attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
That was unpleasant. That was supposed to be our ID, but something happened to it. Good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, and we're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view past guests, upcoming interviews, and access our archives to past shows. There are nearly 200 interviews up and available now, so be sure to check them out. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Barbara will be back with you next week. Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, we bring you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books out into the world, onto our shelves, and into our lives. And this morning I'm joined for the entire hour by the wonderful Ursula Hagee. Ursula is the author of Sacred Time, Hotel of the Saints, The Vision of Emma Blah, Tearing the Silence, Salt Dancers, Stones from the River, which was an Oprah book club selection in 1997, Floating in My Mother's Palm, Unearned Pleasures and Other Stories, Intrusions, Trudy and Pia, and most recently, The Worst Thing I've Done, which is available now and published by Touchstone, a division of Simon & Schuster. She's also the recipient of more than 30 grants and awards, including an NEA Fellowship and 5 Penn Syndicated Fiction Awards. She joins me this morning from Los Angeles. Ursula, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Marie. I'm glad to be part of it.
Oh, I'm glad you're here. You know, before we get into the new book, I want to spend some time talking about the evolution of your writing and sort of the arc of your body of work. From what I gather, you began writing as a small child in Germany in the years just after World War II and have been writing ever since. So perhaps you could kind of take us on a journey from your early work through that pivotal time when you began writing about your experiences as a German in America and then through today.
Sounds good. I learned how to read when I was 5, and I figured at that time the only thing that could possibly be more exciting than reading would be to write. And I started writing then, poems, half stories, whole stories. I have half a novel that I started when I was in my early teens. I would walk along the Rhine River and sit on the jetties and write very gloomy teenage poetry. It's always been part of me, and but I never knew anyone else who wrote. Mm-hmm. But for example, once my kids started going to school, there were other writers who would come to their classrooms and talk about writing, and they had the writers in the school program, and they, you know, probably, as all over this country, you know, kids made their own books. But there was nothing like that when I was a kid. And even as I grew up and came into this country, I always thought of myself as a closet writer, something I did, something that I had to do. And I knew that even if no one ever read my work, I'd keep writing. Mm-hmm. And I certainly did that for a number of years. My first novel, Intrusions, was actually my third written novel. There were two unpublished novels before that. And I took great comfort in reading about writers who perhaps had four unpublished novels right. for their first one. And I once heard about someone who had 17, and I thought, okay, each time with each novel, you know, I'm just going to keep going. And, I still feel that same way, Marie. Even if starting tomorrow no one would ever read me again, I would keep writing. Mm-hmm. I don't write to communicate. That's not the catalyst, even though if communication happens out of my writing, that's wonderful. But what drives me to write, I mean, some of it is very mysterious to me, but what usually drives me to settle on certain material is a certain tension between me and the material, something that does not leave me alone. Mm-hmm. And one of my readers once said, you know, you write about things most of us don't dare look at. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't dare look at it. That's why I have to write about it. So it's, for example, being on book tour now, the tough part about it is that I'm separated from my writing, from the doing of it. I'm talking about it. I'm, traveling with the book that just came out, but I'm not connected to the book that I'm currently writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when I'm not writing, it feels like part of me is just off. It's for me, it's always been like breathing.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Natural and that, you know, integral to my life.
Yeah, that's nice. Now, when you so there isn't a lot of fear when you approach the page. I know your character, which I want to get into this later, but you write very eloquently in this novel about the process of art, a different type of art, but the process of art and coming to the blank page. But you don't experience that in your own work. It doesn't sound like.
Oh, every day I experience that. In addition to all the other stuff, I mean, it's as a writer, I start off with nothing. You know, perhaps a glimpse, perhaps something that unsettles me or intrigues me, and the fiction grows out of that. You know, my imagination comes in, the subconscious, and whatever was the catalyst is so transformed. I do between 50 and 100 revisions before I let something go. And it's sort of the difference between a five-minute conversation in a lobby and a 20-year relationship, you know, where you really get to know someone very, very deeply. And I like revising. First drafts can be incredibly difficult, or sometimes they rush at me, and it's wonderful then.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Any one of the central characters in The Worst Thing I've Done does collages, and I wanted her to have work that I really could understand from the inside out. And my husband is an artist, and I'm the first one to sort of see his work. He's the first one to look at mine. And we've had a lot of conversations about the, about the similarities. I guess in all the art forms, the creating something from something that was not there before.
Right.
And the discovery of that. And the, Annie does collages, the many, many, many layers of finding out for herself what she really is depicting.
Right. I want to step back just for a moment and talk about the process you yourself went through when you embraced your German heritage and started writing about that aspect, because from interviews that I've read and things that I've read, it sounds like you had, when you came to America, you had sort of separated that part of yourself. And then there was kind of a process, it sounds like, of rediscovery and digging into that in your work. Can you talk about how kind of how that came about and when you made the transformation to get in more in touch with your German ancestry?
When I came over here as an 18-year-old, I was stunned because Americans my age told me things about Germany that I didn't know. Mm. In Germany, and I actually, a book eventually came out of that called Tearing the Silence on being German in America. And my question was I the only one who hadn't been told? I wanted to find out what it was like for other German-born Americans of my generation. So, for example, for me, the Holocaust was never mentioned. We were surrounded by evidence of war, and people talked about the war. There were bombed out buildings. There were men who had arms or legs missing. A lot of kids in my school who didn't have fathers. But it was always from the angle of the war, not the Holocaust. Mm. And my parents didn't speak about it. My teachers didn't speak about it. And the clergy didn't speak about it. And in history lessons, we would, you know, start off with the old Greeks and old Romans and go right up to the beginning of the 20th century and then slide right back to the old Romans and the old Greeks. And we knew a lot about them, but we knew very little about our birth country's current political history. I read the diary of Anne Frank when I was about 13. Mm. I was part of a Catholic youth group, and one of the kids there gave it to me, and I was totally stunned by that. So I knew a little bit, and I found out a little bit more. But this overall silence that we grew up with, my generation, and I found out in the book of interviews that it was like that for, I think there was one exception, one person I interviewed with her parents did tell her about the Holocaust, but that really was an exception. And when I came to this country, I felt, I felt more visible in terms of my birth country, I believe, than I would have felt had I stayed in Germany. Mm. People would ask me questions, and I would be, something within me would retreat right back in, right to that familiar silence of my childhood. Mm-hmm. And I still remember when I taught at the University of New Hampshire. I was in grad school and had a teaching assistantship there, and I walked into the faculty mailroom, and two of my colleagues were talking about a Holocaust documentary, and I backed right out. Mm. I couldn't breathe. I backed out, and it was not because I never thought about it, but because I thought about it all the time. And gradually, I began to write about it because I was terrified to look at it. I started in, actually my second unpublished novel was set in Germany, but in the post-war years. And I then wrote my third published book, Floating in My Mother's Palm. I wrote about Germany in the late 50s, and my editor said, it's full of the Holocaust. And I said, I didn't see the Holocaust in there directly mentioned, but the impact of it. When she said it, I could see it was there. Mm. And then with Stones from the River, by then I knew on some level that eventually I would have to write about Germany in the years of the Holocaust. And I was terrified of it. Even as I started writing the book and doing the research, I wanted to run from it at times, you know, from what I was finding out, but I also I couldn't have put the book down. It came at me faster than anything else I've ever written. I even bought I would write in the car driving, which was not particularly safe, and I finally bought a cassette recorder and took walks, just talking, drove talking into it, and that became Stones from the River. And in the through the perspective of Trudy Montag, who is a dwarf and therefore at risk in Germany in the 30s and 40s, it gave me a way to look at how things started in Germany with the persecution of the Jews and the Romani people and the homosexuals and anyone like Trudy who physically did not fit into the what Hitler and the politician called the norm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you had asked me the question about my German heritage and my background, let's say 25 years ago, I would have felt horrible and tried to change the subject very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of being able to talk about it, being able to look at the Holocaust in terms of what happened in Germany and also, well, let me put it this way. It didn't begin with the Holocaust, okay? It ended with the Holocaust. And what I needed to find out was how did it begin?
Mm.
Because it does not go from someone being harassed on the street to the concentration camps. It it's many, many small acts of omission.
Mm.
Excuse me. People looking away when a neighbor is harassed, or people not speaking out for a neighbor whose property is damaged. And it's this accumulation of increasingly violent acts or acts of omission that eventually made the Holocaust possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued by the fact that the Holocaust was so much in your work before you were aware of it being in your work, and how much of our subconscious is on the page, whether or not we're aware that it's on the page, and
absolutely,
and then becoming aware of it and walking head on into it is such an act of bravery. I think that's an incredible story. I'm also curious about writing in your second language. I assume English is your second language growing up in Germany, and
yep.
Making that transition to getting the idioms right and the metaphors right, and I'm wondering if you're ever tempted to write in German, or if that is a language that you've left behind now.
In German, I have the vocabulary of an 18-year-old. It hasn't grown. And excuse me, I'm just going to take a sip of water.
Sure, sure, sure.
I have in English I have the vocabulary of a 61-year-old, and it keeps growing and changing on a daily basis because I live surrounded by this language.
Mm.
So I probably have 50 shades of blue in English, and in German I may have 3 or 4.
Mm. Interesting. Interesting.
So my vocabulary is much richer in English, and I find I could very easily translate from German into English because I understand what I see on the page, and I would have many, many choices for translation, but I could never translate my voice, my fiction from English into German because I just, the vocabulary is not as mature as it is in English.
Right, right. Very interesting. Yeah, it's funny to have made that switch so completely and totally, where a language that was your mother tongue and something that you grew up with kind of stopped abruptly at a certain age and picked up with something else. That's so interesting. So interesting.
Well, it was a gradual change, Marie. I had English for 9 years in school. You know, as you do in many European countries, you start your first foreign language when you're about 9, and your second, which in my case was French, when you're about 12. And so I had 9 years of English, but it was the nun's English, Catholic English,
right.
No swear words, no slang. And when I came to the country, I'd be afraid to open my mouth. I mean, on the page, I could do a lot of things, but my mouth, people would say, huh? And I'd repeat it again, and they'd say, huh? And then I'd sort of whisper it again. So the my spoken English developed sort of in a much slower way. And in the beginning, I was thinking in German, and then translating it inside my head into English, and then answering in English. So there was always that delay, and gradually I started to think more and more in English. And the weird thing was when I went back to Germany, I think it was like 5 years after I had arrived here, and the same thing started happening, but in a reverse kind of way. I would hear people say something in German, and I would have to take it inside and translate it into English to understand it. So there would be the delay, at least for a couple of days, and then it switched. But there would be the delay answering in German, and people told me I had an accent. And I had an American accent, and it made me realize that, you know, wherever I am, I'm going to be mad. As soon as I open my mouth, people are going to know I'm not from there. And it was a really, it really struck me as something that all of us as immigrants share, that we, in terms of language and customs and orienting ourselves as to where we are, we live along this border between our birth country and our adopted country. It doesn't matter from where we come, and it's a border that's shifting.
Yes, right, right. Amazing. I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Ursula Hege, author of many things, but most recently, The Worst Thing I've Done. And we should probably start talking about it, because time is drifting away from me. why don't you tell us about The Worst Thing I've Done, perhaps kind of a brief introduction to the subject matter and how it came to be in your mind.
Well, excuse me.
The only thing about these morning shows is that they come right after I've had my, you know, three cups of coffee with all the cream, and then I have the same problem. I have to keep clearing my throat.
Yes, yeah. Well, it is set on the east end of Long Island, where I live now. Not exactly where I lived, but I've set it in a small town there called North Sea. And at the core of the novel is a wonderful closeness and friendship among three neighborhood kids. They grew up in the same, you know, they've known each other since birth, really. One of the mothers is the babysitter for the entire neighborhood. So they spent their days together, and it's a magical friendship. It's very, very close. Annie, Mason, and Jake. But it's a friendship that grows dangerous for them on the line when they become adults. And it's also about an artist's journey. You mentioned Annie's art before, toward reconnecting with her work. And it's about how we can choose our mothers, our families. And throughout, for me, there is a sense of something having gone too far and the characters having missed the moment that happened, the moment where they could still turn back.
Beautiful. How did the idea arise in your mind for the novel?
When my husband Gordon and I were traveling in the early 90s in Spain, we were on a hill above Granada, this castle, and we had hiked up there, and near the castle wall, which was very low, about just table height, next to us were three teenagers, late teens, and two men and a woman. And one of the men was kissing the woman, and it started out as a sort of a sexual teasing, and then it became a struggle, and he backed her against this low wall and kissed her, bending her backward. And the other men just watched, didn't do anything to interfere. And the woman very quickly turned the situation around by turning and pressing the man who was kissing her, or the man whom she was kissing, against the wall. And she seemed to be equal in strength, and she didn't seem to feel threatened in any kind of way, because otherwise I would have done something. But I was very uncomfortable with the situation, but I was really, really fascinated by whatever it was that was going on among the three of them, because the other men watched.
Amazing.
Amazing. And then when I started the book, I was riding my bicycle, or just around the time I started it, I was riding my bicycle on Long Island, and there were three five-year-old kids, about 5 years old, setting up a lemonade stand. Mm. And the same dynamics on a childhood level, but the pleasing and the bullying and the I just felt, okay, these are the same people as children. And something with me when I write, things that are seemingly unrelated at first, they connect, they suck onto each other, and out of that connection create something new.
Yeah, and I am so intrigued by these setups of trios, and I want to talk about that after the break too. These, you know, it's such a classical situation with the Trinity or the government, or you know, everything is set up in threes, and it creates such a unique set of tensions and more layers of problems than the traditional one-on-one characters. So that's wonderful. You know, maybe
it's an interesting insight, because of bringing the political in too, as you do. I'll have to think about that, Marie. I like that.
Yeah. When I was thinking about this, because everybody in the novel has a dual relationship with everyone else. They're not just one thing to each other. They're more than one thing to each other. And so I was thinking of trios, and so many of them come to mind, you know, in like I say, in politics, in religion.
Good insight, yes.
It's interesting. You know, maybe I'll have us close this half hour with you doing a reading from the novel, and that'll set the stage for further discussion of it when we come back.
Okay.
I'll remind our listeners once again, I'm speaking with Ursula Hege, author of The Worst Thing I've Done.
So I'm going to read to you from the beginning of chapter 2. The point of view is that of Annie. The day I married Mason, my mother's belly was enormous. Ankles swollen, she danced with my new husband, her strawberry hair wild, her purple dress not a mother of the bride dress. And when she cut in on my father's dance with me, she mocked tradition, led me in a tango like a big-bellied man pressing into me, her ring flickering where her hand guided mine. As my sister kicked from within her, she filled all space between us, as though the three of us were intended to fit together like this. On the drive home from the wedding reception, a truck jackknifed into my parents' Honda, swatting them aside, killing my father. My mother lived just long enough to have my sister cut from her in the ambulance. Whenever I imagine my mother and sister still joined by the cord in those minutes before birth and death, my sister's mouth is sucking air, seeking my mother. My sister is pink, not yet the bluish white of thin milk, not yet inert and scrawny, not yet attached to wires and tubes inside the incubator, where I would see her that night and give her the name my parents had chosen when the ultrasound had revealed a girl, Opal. Mine to keep, to raise then. The morning Mason and I brought Opal home to our apartment at UNH, we propped the hospital's car seat on our bed and sat on either side of her, scared to speak or move, watching over her as she slept, her tiny body one pulse beat like that of a bird if you cup it in your palms to see if it's injured. When she awoke, screaming, arms flailing, I swept her against me. Her legs scrambled, and her screams ripped into me till she became my sorrow, knees kicking my breasts as if she were trying to climb through my skin and into my womb. I feel like such an imposter, I said. We're both imposters, Mason said, and stepped behind me, brought his arms around me, around Opal. You think her body remembers the accident, I asked? She wasn't born yet. Still, I molded my back against him, and he rocked me, us, while she kept screaming. I was terrified of her. Since we are imposters, he said, and since she is ours now, her snot and tears hot against my neck. She will be ours, right, Annie? My parents' lawyer had mentioned adoption. Unthinkable. We can't just give her to someone else, I told Mason. Then he said, we may as well be the best damn imposters we can dream up. Like playing house, I said. Like being awesome parents, so much hope in his voice. I miss them so. I miss them too. He kissed me between my shoulder blades. You think she's hungry? We could try feeding her, he said. I'll go read the instructions on the formula. Supporting Opal's head, I laid her into Mason's arms. He stroked her tummy with his thumb, murmured to her, what are we going to do with you?
That was Ursula Hagee reading from her latest book, The Worst Thing I've Done, available now and published by Touchstone. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but Ursula will remain with me for the rest of the show, so please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Planetary Radio is public radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco, Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. And though I played our promo advertising the show on Thursdays at 5, please know we have now moved to Wednesday mornings at 9. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back with you again next week. And I've been speaking with Ursula Hagee for the past half hour, author of many wonderful books, including Stones from the River, but most recently, The Worst Thing I've Done, published by Touchstone and available in bookstores now. Ursula, welcome back.
Thank you.
So many things to talk about, but I kind of wanted to get back into this this role of your characters and the dual role that the characters serve to each other. And, you know, it's just such a fascinating concept that Annie is both mother and sister to Opal. Even some of the minor characters, there's a character named Stormy who is Annie's mother's friend, but she kind of calls her aunt. And everybody is something to someone else. And I want to know how intentional was that? Did it evolve as the novel evolved, or was it there from the beginning?
No, that very much evolved as the novel evolved. I knew very early on that Annie would be both a sister and mother to Opal. And I actually... That was something that started very, very early, too, because long before I started the book, I had, and I have the passage here, I was on a bus in Italy from Siena to San Gimignano, and the entry is dated 2/15/99. And I'll read you what I wrote at that time. My infant sister came to live with me the week after I married Julio. Some of my friends still say I was more of a mother to her than a sister. And that's what it felt like from the beginning. At my wedding, my mother had been present, large in belly, her ankle swollen as she danced first with my father, then with my new husband, and finally with me, cutting in on my father's dance with me, breaking tradition by leading me across the dance floor as if she were a large-bellied man, her round, hard belly pressing into my flat belly, filling all space between us, as if we had always been intended to fit together like this. My mother, the child between us, and I. From the beginning, she was both to me, sister and daughter. And that passage, you know, has not changed a whole lot. I have no idea where it came from.
No, that's amazing. So that passage in 99 came far before you started working on the novel itself.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I started working in the, on the novel, I think, 2003.
Amazing. Huh.
But then, you know, I look through the notes whenever I start a book. I look through a lot of my notes, and some of them start sucking on to each other. But some of my notes I forget, of course, but this one was one that kept churning at me, and it seemed to fit also in with the characters we had seen in Spain several years before this entry, yeah.
It's amazing. It's encouraging to know that, you know, notes you make today may, they're not always lost. They may come back and serve a purpose later on. And experiences that you have today may surface
absolutely
later on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I probably 90% of what I jot down I'll never use, but it informs, I think, on some level what I'm writing. It's sort of like scaffolding.
I love that. I also want to talk about point of view, because it was such a uniquely handled in this novel. It began very much as Annie's, it felt like it began as Annie's story. Most of it was done in third person, but then there were some very interesting point of view shifts, including Mason's point of view. I don't think I'm giving anything away here by saying that Mason committed suicide early. We know that early in the novel.
We know that in the first sentence.
Right. Very early in the novel. And his point of view is very artfully, comes through his suicide note.
Well, actually, it's stream of consciousness. Oh. It's not a suicide note. It's it's an imaginary conversation that he has with Annie in the hour before his death.
Oh, okay, okay. Oh, I misinterpreted. And they have a lot of, they do have a lot of imaginary conversations throughout the novel. In, I guess he has his imaginary conversation, and then she also imagines how he would react to things later on.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
very, very interesting. Did Point of View give you any particular problems, or how did you, how did that kind of emerge as you were writing the book?
Emerge is the word for Emily, because I initially, those short Mason passages that that come in between each of the full-size chapters, they were all in one chapter. And what I wanted was Mason's voice everywhere in the novel. Mm-hmm. So I tried this chapter at the beginning. I tried it as chapter 7, as chapter 3. And it just, what I wanted it like a pulse coming in. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, probably after about 50 or 60 drafts, I tried this form. I took the chapter and separated it into 10 passages that come in between the other chapters, and also have a relationship to the chapter before and the chapter after. But it's Mason's voice in... it starts in the middle of the sentence. It starts in the middle of a page. It it comes in and out. For example, the first time we get Mason's voice is after the end of chapter one, and it's called Mason, and it starts mid sentence. Ask me, Annie. Mm-hmm. Ask me what's the worst thing I've done. Ask, God damn it, because then you'll know I'll never go beyond last night. You'll know and let me stay with you and Opal. And it keeps coming in. To me, in terms of point of view, I mean, there are other points of view too, but I was very excited when I realized that that would be the form for the book. And I really believe that content determines the form. You know, and I've written books in different forms.
How difficult is it for you to write in, you wrote some of it from Opal's point of view, and Opal, she's various ages throughout, but, you know, in general, she's a small child. And I know authors who really struggle with capturing a child's point of view, and Opal was very grounded to me in nature and in observing the physical world. How hard was it to write from a young girl's point of view?
Yeah, whenever I write from the point of view of a character, I need to become that character. To write about Opal's feelings, about her fears, about what she sees, I need to be 9 years old. Just as in Stones from the River, I needed to be a dwarf to write from inside the point of view of a dwarf. I need to be Mason in the last hour of his life. And, so I do very much as in method acting. I do become the character. I'll sit at my desk crying or laughing or blushing, and I need to experience those feelings. So with Opal, of course, there was the additional challenge of language, of vocabulary, because in order to be authentic, coming through in the point of view of a child, I need to be within the vocabulary that's accessible to her.
Right.
And it takes many drafts, you know, in terms of getting to know the characters, but also writing in language that's unique to that character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to get back to the collages and the visual arts, because I really thought one of the gorgeous things in this novel is the way Annie approaches her art, and I thought it was so resonant with the way writers approach writing, and we talked about that briefly.
Absolutely.
Before. And I know in the acknowledgments you talked about a visual artist that you worked with on getting advice on the collages, and I'm kind of curious about what you learned during that process of spending time with the visual artist and how it applies to the writing process.
Yeah, I had talked to both my husband, who paints, you know, who works in oils, and to Nan Olszewski, who is a collagist. And we had talked about collages, and I had done a lot of research about collages, red and red, and but I didn't know what it would feel like to actually do one. Mm. She had told me that when you get this glue on your fingers, it feels like pulling off old skin when you pull off the glue. And so she invited me into her studio to make a collage, and I was amazed by what happened, because I thought I would just sort of learn things about different techniques. But when we were there, she said, just make a collage. And I thought, what could I make? And I thought, okay, I'm going to make the collage that I think Annie would make at this point of the novel. She has made already 15, at this point, 15 collages of the raft, something she witnessed between Mason and Jake when they were boys. And it's a but she keeps going back to that image, and it keeps changing. And throughout the book, there are 17. And what I started doing was what I perceived to be the 16th, the next to last of her collages. And I became Annie, in a way. I started seeing what she would be seeing, what she would be discovering in this. And I had a cassette recorder with me, and I talked into it as I, you know, as I was making this collage. And the picture of the raft emerged, and what I realized was that we're before just part of the girl Annie watching was in the collage. Now Annie had stepped into the collage, and it was sort of what she realizes happens actually between Mason and Jake. They're not just playing around, jumping and pushing each other on the collage. There is something, something much more seductive happening there. Mm-hmm. And she starts to understand why she keeps going back to this.
Mm.
And it was, the strange thing is, Marie, I've never been able to draw or paint. I'm just horrible at it. I know how to paint with words, but that's about it. But with a collage, the different layers, adding them, adding textures, adding sand and branches and rice paper, and it was like revising, and I know how to revise, and I liked actually what I came up with. Mm. And Nan really liked it, and Gordon liked it, and it's hanging in my house. Actually, I feel, I feel good about it.
Amazing. And you had gorgeous descriptions of Annie just sitting and sort of, you know, staring at the blank canvas for days, and you know, there was something productive in that process. And I think writers go through that too, where
absolutely,
you know, even if you don't have black and white down on the page, something is happening in that process of sitting quietly with the work. Yeah.
Very much so. And I find I will have periods where just I'm in my study but nothing really comes to me. I may get, you know, one sentence, and I may delete four pages or whatever. But then there's always a period of high productivity that follows that. And I know that I cycle like that, you know, where everything I notice comes through and becomes part of the page, and other times where I can't do it, but I need to be there and attempt to do it.
Mm-hmm. It's good to hear this advice, because I think you know, it gives us faith to get through the dark periods. That's nice.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now I am curious about the 50 to 100 drafts and what happens during your revision process. Is it a process of writing something and wholly throwing it out, realizing that it was scaffolding, or is it more of a massaging process? Or I guess in 50-100 drafts, it's probably all of those things.
It's all of those things. You're right. It's like what I have linked it to, Marie, is sticking my hand into a muddy brook, and my fingers find something at the bottom of the brook that feels intriguing enough to close my hand around it. And with each draft, then I bring it closer to the surface, to the water, until I can figure out what it is. And I may just toss it back, you know, because it doesn't intrigue me beyond looking at it. But if it's something that I really, where there is that tension between me and the material, I will keep working to reveal it. And I said earlier, I don't write to communicate. It's this grasping something that I need to understand. Mm-hmm. And it's that with the characters and the worst thing I've done. For example, I had no idea that Jake witnesses Mason's death. I had no idea for a long time. Mm. And I had no idea until I was writing the ending, what he decides to do with that knowledge.
Mm.
Mm. I always follow the characters. I assumed he would do something different with the knowledge, but when I realized, wow, this is his decision, it was like, you know, the character claiming that, okay, this is what he will do. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, I never try to force the characters into anything. And I love not knowing the ending when I'm writing, because if I already knew it, I wouldn't have to write a whole book to get there. And different writers approach writing in different ways. And I think it's important, too, for beginning writers to understand that whatever way we can get at the material, we get at it, and that my way of working will be different from another writer's way of working, and that there are many, many approaches.
Yeah, it's interesting. It feels like when the author knows the ending, the reader knows the ending, because it's so hard to psychologically trick yourself into disguising it from the reader. And you almost know when the author didn't know. You can get a sense of it because it's a discovery together of the amazing thing, rather than the author consciously trying to throw you, the reader, off the path. So
that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It always feels like it's very hard not to tip your hand when, you know, the author is already aware of what's going to happen. It's interesting. And one of the last things that I want to talk about, because I think it's tricky also for new writers, is subplotting, because it can be... subplotting.
Okay.
Because I think when you have a plot in place and characters kind of moving around in it, and finding the appropriate subplot that doesn't overwhelm the main story, yet resonates with it and acts as a nice counterpoint, seems critical and seems difficult to do. And in this, there's a kind of a stream of politics that runs quietly in the background. Certainly there, but it's sort of on the periphery of the novel. But it resonates with the personal is always political sort of underlying theme. And I thought maybe you could talk about how you think of subplots, when you know a subplot is working for the novel, and when it's not.
Yeah, a lot of things about writing I've learned from my own life, in terms of, you talked about the relationships before. Our life is never just about one relationship. You know, we have different relationships. We have, we mean different things to different people. People see us in different ways. And there are many, many subplots in our own lives. And, for example, if my husband were to tell the story about this book tour and I were to tell it, there would be very different stories because of who we are and what we bring to it. So I don't know the story in the beginning. I don't think of sub-stories. It's more that, for example, in a story, I may just have, in a short story, a central plot that I discover along with the characters, but a novel really needs to go beyond that, just as the novel really contains many, many stories and that are connected by an overall story. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are exceptions. You know, for example, right now I'm working on a novel that is set within one day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's not a rule I'm talking about, but I guess my approach to the book, The Worst Thing I've Done, there are the characters, for example, Aunt Stormy, who comes from Germany, feels a strong responsibility to speak out against corrupt politics, which she does. And in a way, Annie is drawn into that too. Annie was not that political to start out with, but she becomes more politically aware with Aunt Stormy when she is staying there.
Mm. Beautiful, beautiful. Any one-word sentence of last-minute advice for our listeners?
keep writing. Honor the gift or the urgency that you feel, and just set, even if you do half an hour a day, but make it a steady time you honor and can count on.
Mm, I like it. Ursula, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
You're very, very welcome.
Huge pleasure. That was Ursula Hagee, author of The Worst Thing I've Done, available in bookstores now and published by Touchstone. I should mention that Ursula is appearing at the Beverly Hills Library this evening at 7:30 and at Warwick's in La Jolla tomorrow evening. You can take a look at Simon & Schuster's website, simonsays.com, for more details on that. And a quote from Mark Twain this morning. So dark in here, it feels like this afternoon. Who said, "The time to begin writing an article is when you have finished it to your satisfaction. By the time you begin to clearly and logically perceive what it is you really want to say." Something that dovetails on the 50 to 100 revisions. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day.